Coming up on Tech News Today, artificial intelligence and Minecraft go together like Pi Day and Pi. Cross-platform gaming comes to the Xbox One. Future sports are freaking awesome, if drone racing is any indication. Microbots that'll tow your car for you. And so much more. Why don't you watch? Tech News Today is next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1469, recorded Monday, March 14th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/TNT to apply for a loan right now.
And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/TNT and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/TNT.
And by Score Big. Pay less for quality seats to your favorite sporting and music events. Go to scorebig.com, click on the microphone, and enter promo code TNT to save $20 off your first ticket purchase. Hello and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about drones and we talk about robots and we talk about games and other tech news.
Lots of motorized things today.
Yes, we take a ride down the information superhighway and hope you'll join us. I'm Megan Maroney.
I'm Jason Howell. What is this information superhighway you're talking about? I've never heard of this before.
I haven't heard of it since 1998.
Sounds very cyber.
It does, yeah.
And unfortunately, we are not bringing gifts of pie for us or for anyone else. But that's okay because our listeners and viewers outside of the U.S. don't care anyway. Because it's not Pi Day for you. It's Pi Day for us. But we have no way to celebrate.
I know. We don't have pie, but I have 3.14155159.
Close.
3.14159.
That's good enough.
That's as far as I can.
Way better than I could have done. Supposedly, there's I was just reading it earlier today. There's a Japanese guy who managed to memorize or be able to figure out and recite in order up to like 100,000 times, digits of pi, which is just kind of crazy.
Yeah, I'm
not going to touch that record. No. In fact, I'm not even going to try. I'll just make myself look like an idiot. Instead, let's talk about our first story today. Microsoft has been hinting at cross-platform play with its Xbox One for a little while now in different ways. And today, made good on those hints. Developers can build in support when developing Xbox One and Windows 10 games to basically be able to play cross-platform. Cross-platform play between the Xbox One and the Sony PlayStation 4. It sounds like it's potentially possible. Like Microsoft has basically done what they need to do to make that happen. But there's still things that Sony would have to do in order to activate that. Of course, this is early in the week with the
Game Developers Conference
is going on right now. So who knows? I mean, maybe we'll hear something from Sony about that as the week progresses. But for right now, it's pretty much between the Xbox One and the Windows 10 PC. And so that they can kind of compete live across the platforms, which is kind of a big deal when you consider these, the consoles for so long. All these different platforms have kind of, in many ways, just kind of been isolated from each other. And, and I think the thought there is so that they could sell more consoles, keep it locked down to just the Xbox One. And then, people would kind of get locked into that console and have to almost be forced to take sides. What I wonder is that the different consoles, PC, the different consoles, they kind of approach game development differently. Like each console has its own strengths, and PC gaming, let's say, has its own strengths, but a very different kind of control methods. So, on PC gaming, people are using their keyboard and their mouse to do these, kind of controls versus a console where they're using a controller. And I wonder if when you're doing cross-platform gaming, if that gives any of those sides kind of like an edge over the other. Like, is one easier or does one, allow for kind of finer-tuned control depending on the game? But yeah.
That is a mystery to me. The only game that is played in my house, the most mostly, is Minecraft.
Oh, okay.
And yesterday, Microsoft announced that they're open sourcing a project called AIX, or maybe it's pronounced X. It's a platform that uses the game Minecraft to train and improve artificial intelligence. I found this story fascinating. So the open world of Minecraft offers just basically endless possibilities. And apparently this makes it really easy, an easy place to train a digital assistant. AI agents roam the world of Minecraft, and now a private beta will allow select academic researchers to get involved as well. So this was interesting. I mean, Minecraft is allegedly making children smarter, also making robots smarter.
Why not make the robots smarter? The robots really need help getting smart, don't they? Because they're not very smart, are they? I think what's interesting about this is that AI largely, you know, involves feeding a computer information, and then here's the information that we're giving you. Now learn lessons based on this information, you know, and grow from there. And in regards to something like Minecraft, I mean, how players play it, and then potentially, you know, how kind of like the AI maneuvers through it. It's really about giving this vast tool set and kind of an unlimited kind of play field, and allowing it to just use that environment to learn lessons itself. So what they're thinking is, like, you know, instead of, let's say, building a robot in order to, you know, figure out how to teach the robot to climb up a mountain, you build the robot, it falls down. Now, now maybe it broke, so you have to go fix it and blah, blah, blah. Instead of doing that, plopping it into a universe like Minecraft and allowing it to figure out on its own over time how to traverse the mountain. And maybe that, you know, informs how the robot is built later.
Unfortunately, then we can't get all those YouTube videos of the robots falling down.
Well, we can. We'll just probably be destroyed at some point when the robots finally figure out that we're laughing at them. So,
yeah, I think this is an interesting announcement. I mean, not everyone can be involved now. It's select academics. Mm-hmm. But it definitely is fascinating because we've talked a lot about Go, you know, the difference between a robot winning checkers and then a robot winning chess and then a robot winning Go, like a robot beating this completely open world of Minecraft. I mean, I guess there's not really anything to beat. There's survival
mode. And that's the big difference, right? At least with a game of Go or a game of chess, you know what the end game is. There is an actual end game. And in the case of Minecraft, it's really just kind of creation is the game, at least in the way that they're going to be doing this. So,
right. Well, there's creative mode and there's survival mode.
Right.
So you know what the end game is in survival mode.
I don't know. I'm kind of looking forward to the worlds that the AI creates. I mean, granted, you can have randomized, you know, world generation in video games. Mind you, I have not played Minecraft, so I don't know if you can randomize the world generation. I'd be really surprised if you couldn't. But to put an actual, like, robotic AI behind it and with some, like, thought behind it would be kind of an interesting experiment to see what kind of levels it came up with. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Sounds kind of cool to me.
It's amazing.
Maybe they make a shrine for one of us just on their own. They just figure it out to be like, you know what? I'm a really big fan of Tech News Today.
Right. Probably they've been listening how we have tried to be kind to robots. We don't support kicking robots. Or we speak nicely to
digital systems. No, we never show those videos on our show. Never. Remember how Google's self-driving car slowly, and I do mean slowly, veered out into a bus that was passing by, causing its first autonomously guided accident? This is actually video footage from it. It just kind of happens and boom. Oh, that was it. Well, in a strangely coincidental move, a patent that was actually filed by Google in 2014 and published last week on March 8th addresses exactly this type of scenario. So it's such kind of a strange incident of this thing happens, and coincidentally they filed a patent for just this very thing a while back, and it's happened. So bus detection for an autonomous vehicle, it uses image recognition to basically detect how big, or, you know, if it's a yellow, let's say, school bus. In regards to the patent, it's isolated to school bus, but you have to imagine they're going to open it up. And then it triggers a more cautious driving action as a result. So it's like it puts on caution mode.
Right, because bus drivers are crazy.
Oh, yeah, especially school bus drivers. I had a couple of crazy school bus drivers.
I keep thinking of the school bus driver in Simpsons.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. I had one that was almost like Otto. Almost.
Otto. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is fascinating. When you think about how far self-driving car technology has come, It's come a long way, but there's still so much more for cars to understand, mm-hmm. For computers inside the cars to understand. They haven't even tested them really in winter weather. Like, they don't even know what they're going to do. And so, I mean, you think about where they're testing them, Austin, yeah. Silicon Valley, like, you know, there's so much further to go. And it's fascinating too. Chris Urmson, I think, was speaking at South by Southwest, and when he was asked about this, he said, "It won't happen again." That's a very serious. You know, they're learning. It's learning.
So. Yeah, 3,500 tests that they've done since just that bus incident happened alone. So I mean, they're cranking through at this point to assure that it won't happen again. We'll see if that happens or doesn't happen. However you want to say it.
A new report by The Guardian says that Facebook, Google, and Snapchat are increasing their use of encryption in light of Apple's ongoing battle with the FBI. Over the weekend, The New York Times also said that WhatsApp is going to be the next target. I know WhatsApp in Brazil had some battles over encryption that Mark Zuckerberg talked publicly about, but now they've come to the U.S. Nate Cardoza, who we had on the show a few weeks ago, says we can expect a multi-pronged attack on apps next. WhatsApp will encrypt phone calls within weeks, and Snapchat is reportedly working on a secure messaging service. And meanwhile, last night, John Oliver made his signature effort to make Americans understand and care about a previously confusing topic, this time encryption. I said a few weeks ago, like, he really needs to do this to make people care.
Yeah, you knew he was going to eventually.
Yeah, it was pretty funny. I mean, I looked desperately for some clips to watch, but most of them are not so family friendly. So you'll have to watch it yourself.
That's kind of how it goes.
I've actually tried to watch John Oliver with my children before, and it's because he's so funny and smart. And then all of a sudden it's just like, oh, wait a minute, you probably should be at least 14 or 15 before I let you watch this.
Instead, we can pull quotes from it, like, "We're barely one step ahead of hackers at all time, and join us as we dance madly on the lip of the volcano."
Which so that's is the, base, big, yeah, the so big Apple commercial.
Yeah,
at the end.
The big finale at the very end. You know, this whole thing about apps. So the New York Times also reported over the weekend that there's a case in New York involving a wiretap order that's being stifled basically by WhatsApp encryption. Of course, WhatsApp isn't encrypting their voice calls yet, but they've been encrypting their messages, at least on Android, for the last couple of years. And in this case, they want to tell, you know, they want the judge to force WhatsApp, hello message, to get to the encrypted data, to the data that they basically can't get to through the case. So, I mean, what we're seeing here is kind of a broader implementation and kind of like you said, a warning to app developers that if you're building an app, then you are, you know, under the microscope potentially if it benefits a case, let's say, down the line. And if you're building an app with encryption, it behooves you to make sure that you have no way of getting access to that data and building a system that basically takes it out of your hands. Otherwise, yeah, you might be forced to, you know, compelled by law to hand that over.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's a small part of what we've been talking about for a long time. Since this whole Apple versus FBI thing started, that for big companies, it's not that hard. I mean, for Apple, it's not that hard to pay a bunch of lawyers and to try, right. You know, to fight this. But then on Friday, we talked about that Edward Snowden case where it was a smaller company that just had to fold because mm-hmm. they just couldn't, you know, they couldn't do anything about it. So, I mean, WhatsApp, of course, is owned by Facebook, so they have the same lawyer money. But it will be interesting to see what happens next.
Yes.
On Friday, we covered the failings of the iOS App Store. The Google Play Store may be doing it better. We'll find out. But first, let's take a minute to thank Prosper, the sponsor of this episode. In today's economy, cash really is king. So instead of getting stuck with high interest rate credit cards, go to Prosper.com. Prosper's online marketplace connects people who need money with those who want to invest. And they want to invest in you. It's like Uber or Airbnb for borrowing money. You can use Prosper to borrow up to $35,000 in as few as 5 days. With Prosper.com, you can borrow money for just about anything you want. You can pay off high-rate credit cards. You can fix up your house. You can get a green loan for environmentally friendly projects. You can remodel your kitchen or your bathroom. You can even plan a vacation. Anything you want, it is your money. If I had a loan, I would build a giant robot that could do my laundry, respond to all my emails, help my kids with their homework, and come up with funny things to say about technology on Twitter, because that would be worth it. Prosper.com is a better way to get the cash you need at a low interest rate. To check your low rate instantly without affecting your good credit, Go to prosper.com/TNT for up to $35,000 in your account in as few as 5 days. Go to prosper.com/TNT. That's prosper.com/TNT.
All right, joining us now is Nate Swanner from The Next Web. How's it going, Nate?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Doing fantastic. Thank you so much for taking some time to join us today. Google made some announcements, of course, timed with the opening of the Game Developer Conference today. And I guess, first off, Nate, tell us a little bit about this indie corner section. Actually, kind of is somewhat of an answer to something we were talking about last week. But what's this all about?
Indie Corner is kind of it's going to be this interesting place inside of the Play Store where independent teams of developers or independent developers that make games by themselves are featured. Google says that independent developers make up a huge portion of the games on the Play Store, and they really have the Indie Corner to highlight games that are unique and do all sorts of cool things that Google wants them to do, like the leaderboards and things like that. So that's really what Indie Corner is about.
Do developers have to go kind of out of their way in order to be considered for that, or is Google kind of vetting it on their own?
Independent developers or the teams have to submit a game and say, hey, this is really cool. I want my game featured. From there, Google kind of checks the game out. Somebody actually plays the game to make sure it's a unique experience and not like a reskinned, you know, Flappy Bird clone or something terrible like that. So it's vetted by humans, but independent developers do have to submit games.
Terrible Flappy Bird clones. That never happens.
Never.
I'm very curious to see. I mean, obviously, this is just one facet of the Play Store and kind of the marketing and, you know, recommendation engine behind it. Very interested to see if this kind of tackles what, Megan, what we were talking about last week with Rene Ritchie from iMore, just about the challenge that indie developers in general have at exposure, because there's so many apps in the App Store, you know, both, you know, in all mobile app stores at this point, pretty much, maybe save for Microsoft. And so being discovered, having any sort of spotlight on you is so difficult because you're just surrounded by all this other stuff. Do you think this will help?
I think it'll help a little bit. I'm hoping Google parlays this into something for a broader scope of independent developers. Obviously, it's about monetization. For developers, if you look at any kind of monetization reports, the games are always making a disproportionate amount of the money. Yeah. So that's where a lot of developers focus their energy anyway, especially independent developers. So I think it will do some good because discovery is hard. No matter what platform you're on, search in the App Store or Play Store is still terrible.
Yeah.
So hopefully this helps with discovery, and I really hope that they parlay it in something bigger.
So strange that search is as bad as it is in these things.
What about YouTube Live? What can you tell us about that?
YouTube Live was something that Google announced previously. What they're going to do with Play Games is developers can basically allow gamers to use the camera the front-facing camera, so the onlookers can look at them. It's going to record their screen. So it's basically a lot like Twitch does with recording games. It's just doing it for mobile. And Google and YouTube have had a huge push into trying to get into the gaming ecosystem that way via YouTube. So that's really what it is. It's just about, you know, recording your reactions to what's going on and then uploading it automatically in the game.
Yeah, very cool that developers can kind of just bake that in, tap into the API that way. Now, another big challenge for developers is getting people to try your app in the first place. Explain a little bit about this. This is very cool. And we've seen a little bit of this already before, but explain app streaming and for kind of how that relates to ads kind of going forward.
So the streaming thing, when you search for a game, because again, we go back to the Play Store search, it's kind of terrible. So you might search in Google search. So if you search for a game, you'll get a little pop-up banner that says try now, so you can try the game. Google says you can play it for 10 minutes and it's the game, the proper game, not some sort of weird skinned experience where it just dumps you into gameplay. It's the game as you would download it.
So it's not like a flash, Adobe Flash like recreation. This is what it would be like if you had it on your phone. How exactly is this streaming happening, and do we know if there's any kind of latency? Like, I've seen a little bit of app streaming in the past. It wasn't in a game, it was more an app, and it seemed pretty responsive, but you know, using an app versus using a game or playing a game, kind of two different scenarios. How are they pulling this off?
Google's kind of cagey about their back-end technology for this. Basically what they're doing is kind of letting you tap into the game without downloading it. Mm-hmm.
Like an emulation happening.
Yeah, it's kind of like an emulator, but you're tapping into the game property and the actual app that they're hosting on the Play Store. So they're a little cagey about the actual technology, but it is the game proper.
Cool.
Can you do that with other apps or is it just games?
They're only talking about it for games right now.
In the end, this is as relates to ads, right? So this is like, here's an ad for a game. Oh, you want to try it out? Okay, then here you go. And for a couple of months now, they've been doing kind of a trial, like try it now feature for apps that aren't games. So they kind of have it in other fashions. But it seems like they're kind of broadening it out and moving it into gaming makes a whole lot of sense. I don't know. I know that there were a few other announcements. Anything else that caught your eye in this?
I think the analytics is kind of interesting. What Google's doing is they're giving developers access to the behaviors people have in the apps, and that's going to allow them to monetize their in-app spending better.
Yeah.
So if Google knows that players that I play too much Clash of Clans and I buy too many whatever, they're going to be able to tell the developer, like, this guy is a high target and you should probably send him an ad.
Nice. Okay, so then I have to ask, are you do you spend a lot of time playing Clash of Clans? Should we be worried about you?
I used to, and then I spent too much, and now I can't anymore.
All right. Fair enough. Nate Swanner, it's a pleasure getting you on the show. Thank you so much for coming on. Tell people where they can follow all your work online.
You can follow it on the Next Web or on Twitter at Nate Swanner.
Right on. Thank you so much, Nate. We'll talk to you soon.
Bye-bye.
All right, now's the time where we hear from you. Rami writes, I was listening to your latest episode, and for yet another time, I hear again the reference to the incorrect version of Moore's Law. According to the article on The Economist and many other references on the internet, Moore's Law predicts the processing power doubles roughly every 2 years, some versions 18 months and also 20 months, or even sometimes that the transistor density would double in that period. But what Gordon Moore really predicted in 1965 was that the transistor count on a chip would double every year, then revised it in 1975 to every 2 years. The source is an interview in 2003 with Gordon Moore. Moore also affirmed that he never said transistor count would double every 18 months, as is commonly said. Initially, he said transistors on a chip would double every year. He then recalibrated it to every 2 years in 1975. David House, an Intel executive at the time, noted that the changes would cause computer performance to double every 18 months. So, Mythbusters.
Yeah.
As we ride down the information superhighway, we bust myths.
Rami greater than Wikipedia.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that you went ahead and intentionally brought in a Back to the Future reference with density destiny.
Yes, I try. Yeah, I do my best.
I know. You're a big fan of that movie.
I not as big as you are, but
that might be true.
My youth as well.
Up next, the kids are the ones winning the drone races. Are you at all surprised? I'm not. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, Wealthfront. You invest for the long term, for you, for your family's financial health, but trying to do all that stuff yourself, especially the right way, it's complex, it's time-consuming, it's confusing. Luckily, there's Wealthfront. Traditional advisors charge huge fees between 1% to 3% of what they manage, but with Wealthfront, you pay 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points, zero commissions, no hidden fees. That's less than $5 a month to invest a $30,000 account. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. You can get started investing today, and all you need is as little as $500. It only takes a few minutes to sign up. You go to Wealthfront.com and goes right to work, monitoring your portfolios around the clock, taking action as soon as an opportunity arises. Wealthfront uses modern portfolio theory to determine the best mix of asset classes with the aid of mean variance optimization. This methodology actually allows them to generate the maximum return for every level of risk. Wealthfront is transparent. It's accessible. You can view all your accounts in one place, whether they're personal, joint, or even retirement. You can also see every trade that Wealthfront makes on your behalf in your dashboard, on your desktop, or with their mobile app. Now, unlike other financial advisors, Wealthfront won't bog you down with dozens of questions. They've combed through behavioral economics research, and all that does is that simplifies their risk identification process, which allows you to begin investing sooner. Did you know that more than 90% of portfolios aren't invested the right way for the long term. With Wealthfront's new portfolio review, you can see if your portfolio is at risk, see how diversified your investments are, what you're losing to fees, even minimize your taxes, all for free. Now, Wealthfront manages over $2.6 billion in client assets. It's growing rapidly every single day, so you have no reason to wait anymore. What are you waiting for? Invest in your future today with Wealthfront. Visit wealthfront.com/TNT to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation that they recommend for your portfolio. And just for TWIT listeners, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge for life. Join the many TWIT fans who've seen huge success with Wealthfront and claim your offer today. Just go to wealthfront.com/TNT. And we thank Wealthfront for their support.
The inaugural World Drone Prix was held in Dubai on Sunday, and Mike Murphy from Quartz is here to tell us about it. Welcome, Mike.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going well. What can you tell us about who won?
So it was won by a 15-year-old kid from the UK, from a small part of England called Somerset, which is very I don't know if you know this. I grew up in London, so I know the area pretty well. There's not a lot going on in Somerset, so there's probably a lot of open space to be flying these drones. So I can see why this kid, his name was Bannister, has won.
So how does drone racing work exactly? How are they're controlling it from their own camera? How does it work?
So for a race like this, these drones will all be pretty much custom made, more or less handmade, hand soldered by the pilots themselves. And they usually have, so for like a race like this, probably they'll have just one camera on them. And what that is exactly what you're seeing right now. And then there'll be a radio emitter that basically sends the feed from that camera in real time to a pair of video goggles that are like janky versions of the Oculus that the pilots are using to actually steer. And so you get this cool effect, like when you're watching the video later, of them flying essentially as if, you know, like a bird or pod racing or whatever you want to think of it is.
It's really cool.
Crazy. Like I can only like when things are, it's one thing to like play a video game, move real fast in a video game, but it's another thing to see the video of it and know that like he's really kind of playing this the way you would play a video game. He's got a controller, he's got the feed of the video, but I'm stating the obvious, but one wrong move and the thing actually crashes. Like this just kind of blows my mind that they're this good at it, especially as far as how fast things are moving.
I think it's pretty crazy, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, I went to the biggest competition that's been held in the U.S. Last July, and none of the people who placed in that, none of the winners placed in the top 15 for this competition. A lot of them were there, but they didn't even place. You know, which kind of tells you just how quickly this sport is emerging. And you know, when I wrote my story today about this, I kind of compared it to snowboarding and skateboarding back in the day when they were kind of like outsider sports. And I found out that Shaun White was just 13 when he did his first professional event. So there is, you know, definitely precedent for this sort of thing.
For the young people, being the leaders in the sport in the beginning as it's coming up. Yeah, so wow. I mean, there's a lot of things that might keep this from becoming more mainstream. One is like, I mean, we're watching this now, and anyone can watch it. But like, in terms of like being a spectator sport, is there much to see if you're actually at the event?
So this is a huge problem right now. There's a few companies and a few different organizations that are trying to figure out how to turn this into an actual spectator sport. Right now, I think it works best as a kind of YouTube sport. Mm-hmm. You know, like we just watched that. That's awesome. And I guarantee you hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people will probably end up watching that video. But in terms of when you go there and watch it, especially if it's during the daytime, it's really hard to watch. You're basically watching a dinner plate fly 70 miles an hour in an open field. You know, that's why a lot of them are being held at night, so you can see the track itself a lot better, and they're starting to light up the drones themselves, so you can actually discern, oh, I'm rooting for the green one, or I'm rooting for the blue one. Oh, no, the yellow one just crashed, that sort of thing. So that makes it a little easier, but what I've actually heard from some pilots is, you know, it's all well and good doing all these kind of crazy, you know, course modifications to make them look more awesome. If they're not fun to fly, no one's going to keep coming back. And I don't know about this one. That course looks a little more difficult. but there was a similar kind of like neon crazy, you know, 90s theme drone race like this in the Las Vegas desert around CES that, from what I heard from pilots that were at that, it was pretty much just a straight shot. You know, there wasn't really a lot of challenging curves or twists or anything like that that really, you know, made it interesting for them. Like, and that's obviously what you really need as a pilot if you're going to keep coming back to the sport.
Wow. Yeah. And when you're talking about like future sports, like, which is, this definitely qualifies in that category. Like, I can't, I know it sounds nerdy to think of like an audience with VR goggles on, but I don't know. It kind of also makes sense in a strange way, right? Like, we've got this strange like technology convergence happening here where where VR is kind of coming up. We're kind of, we don't really know what the you know, the next frontier is when it comes to VR technology. We've got flying drones in the way that they're being flown right now. You kind of feel like you're at the beginning of a big, you know, a big kind of new sport when you see something like this. I could totally see it. Like, this is, maybe this isn't the kind of sport that you go and you just sit idly on the sidelines and watch a little dot fly around in the sky. Maybe this is like, you know, the kids who are just grow up accustomed to things like VR understand this sport because it's perfect for it.
Yeah. I mean, I can't see, possible. I can't, when I'm, you know, when you're a big stadium, you can't see a lot anyway. I mean, you're depending on, for any sport, you're depending on the big screen, I guess. So the drones themselves, are they commercial drones, or are they, did each pilot make this drone? How does that work?
So yeah, these are not like the drones you could go buy at Best Buy. These are pretty crazy little machines that are probably about, you know, this big in size compared to my giant face. They're like carbon fiber bodies, and all of the parts are generally bought from like different retailers, different people, and the pilots will all be making them themselves for the most part. There's like a few kits that you can kind of, you know, buy now that'll have all the parts, but you're still going to need to assemble it. This isn't like something that you can just like go, okay, I'm a drone racer now. You like, at this point, you still really need like some amount of engineering ability and some kind of like, you know, electrical wiring ability. This is more than just like, you know, putting a new fuse in your fuse box. These are pretty hard to build right now. And I kind of was like, you know, I've been covering this sport, this growing sport, for about a year, and I've really like, I have a few little like drones, but like, I really want to build one, but at the same time, I don't think I can do it without setting something on fire, like not on purpose.
So the 15-year-old that won built this drone himself, I presume.
Yeah, I think so. I can't confirm that. I haven't spoken to him, but for the most part, people in the sport, they're either flying rigs completely made by themselves, or at least, you know, from parts from sponsors that, you know, they're like, well, these are our new parts. Will you fly these? The only exception really is the Drone Racing League, which was the New York-based league that's going to have races throughout 2016. They all mandate kind of like Formula One, where you basically got one car shape and you kind of have to stick within that. They're mandating that everyone uses their shaped drone, which kind of levels the playing field. I know a lot of these races, I'm not sure about this one so much, but a lot of the previous big races, people have been racing drones that are like this big versus drones that are that big. And the small ones are a lot more nimble, a lot more agile, so they've been winning. But to me, that seems like, you know, racing a stock car against a Formula One car. It's not really fair.
So what's next? Is there another big race coming up next in drones?
There are so many drone races. It's kind of crazy. For these guys, they hope that basically, the Sports Council of Dubai hopes that this will kickstart a drone Grand Prix, and, you know, this will be the kind of Monaco of the Formula One version of them. And don't know if that's going to happen, but the guy who organized the Drone Nationals in California last summer that I went to, he's having another Drone Nationals in New York in August that is going to be on, I think, Randall's Island or one of the islands that isn't very accessible. So that'll be interesting. And then there's the Drone Worlds competition in Hawaii in October, which, if I can figure out a way to get there, definitely going to cover that.
So in addition to covering drones, you also cover AI and machine learning, and you've been covering the AlphaGo versus Lee Sedol Go championship that we've talked about. Tomorrow is the last game of the tournament. Mm-hmm. Today in Seoul, our tomorrow. Tell us, you wrote about, there was a one a win, but you called it a futile win.
Yeah, I've decided to cover this kind of like, this is the start of Skynet, the world doomed, because, you know, the DeepMind, the Google subsidiary behind all this, their CEO has kind of hinted at the big thing here, the big test is like, if this program can figure out how to, you know, can be used in situations other than just like rigidly playing Go or, you know, retooled to, you know, play something else or look at some other kind of data set or something. Like if it can be used in a general capacity to learn, then, you know, that is a huge step on the path to actual artificial intelligence. I don't think we're there, but, you know, that was just something I was kind of thinking about today. But, you know, the reason I really called it futile is because not only is it like, you know, resistance is futile, humanity is destroyed, but like AI already won. You know, the AlphaGo already won. It was a best of five, and it was 3-0 before this game. So I got the impression, and I read a couple blogs of people who play Go, who actually understand what's going on a lot better than I do, who basically said that Lee completely changed his playing strategy for this game, because clearly the weight of expectation was gone. I mean, he'd already lost, so he played a completely different game that was really apparently quite masterful today.
That's interesting.
And yeah, now he's kicking himself. Like, right. Why didn't I do this sooner?
I guess robots haven't figured out that when there's no more pressure, we all perform better, I guess.
We change our strategy. No, yeah. maybe the robot thought, oh, he's going to play the same way he has been. I don't know if there's any memory from one game to the other for the AI, but...
Yeah, well, we'll be covering that case, and the Lee Siu is in South Korea, and she'll be on
She's
the show tomorrow.
There. She's been at the...
watching, yes, watching humans lose to the robots. Mm-hmm. Mike, thank you so much for coming on, as always. Mike Murphy is a reporter at Quartz. That's at QZ.com. Thanks, Mike.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Mike. All right, TNT's fan of the day is J. Chad Gray Ole. Who posted this picture on Instagram saying, quote, I usually podcast the audio, but enjoy watching when I get to work from home. Keep up the good work, guys. To which I say, any way you want to catch the show, video, audio, however you like, you have our full support. Just make sure that your instant messenger doesn't auto sense your media playback and change your status to that. Unless you want your team members to know all about TNT, in which case, do it. Fully support that, too. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video, or you can take a picture of yourself or your setup and post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook, and use the hashtag HowIWatchTNT, and we will find it.
All right. What do you get when you combine an ant, a gecko, and a robot? You will find out after the break. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, Score Big. What is the next big event you want to attend? Perhaps a musical like Hamilton or Wicked, a Foo Fighters concert, or a local baseball game. Maybe you want to bring your entire family to experience the magic of Frozen on Ice. Whatever it is, you can bet that there is a way to pay less for better seats. How? Just go to scorebig.com. 40% of all live event tickets go unsold. ScoreBig makes it easy to attend live events by working directly with your favorite teams and artists to get their unsold seats at unpublished prices. At scorebig.com, you are always guaranteed huge savings by paying much less than what the box office charges for tickets. They have incredible deals on tickets to concerts, sports, Broadway productions, and family-friendly events. To take advantage of these amazing deals, visit scorebig.com and find the event and seats you want. Then make an offer with ScoreBig's name a ticket price feature. You will receive a response from ScoreBig instantly, and you can save up to 60% on your tickets. You also have an option to pay a fixed price, which can be less expensive than major online ticket resellers. With ScoreBig, there are no surprise fees, and you get free shipping. You can even favorite shows and events to be notified on upcoming dates to attend. This is super convenient. Quit overpaying for tickets. Get the tickets you want at prices you can afford with Score Big. The next time you're planning to attend a game or a show, visit Score Big first and see how much you can save. Go to scorebig.com, click on the microphone, and enter the promo code TNT to save an extra $20 off your first ticket purchase. That's scorebig.com, promo code TNT.
All right, Megan, you know how ants are capable of carrying somewhere between 20 to 100 times their own weight? What is it? I'm not really quite sure exactly what
lot,
it is, but it's somewhere
more.
In there, and that's a lot, no matter what, how you slice it. Well, what about micro robots? Stanford University researchers analyzed the properties that make ants so incredibly buff, as well as grippers that are inspired by geckos' feet, and that results in a small army of six tiny micro robots that are shown working together to pull a full-size car. These things are not much larger than like little Hot Wheel cars, you know, those tiny little things. They're tiny. And so basically, all it takes is six of these to kind of inch their way forward. They grip the ground with those gecko feet, sticky things, lots of surface area, that sort of thing. Then they unhook and they pull slowly, and the tensile strength allows them to stay put while the car just kind of inches slowly towards them. Isn't that crazy?
It is amazing.
These things are tiny. They're pulling cars.
I didn't realize we have those little microbots in my house. Like, those are they sell them at Target. The little ones that look like spiders and the tiny little ones that look like bugs.
You know, no big deal. Just tiny little robots pulling a car.
Yeah, I don't think they're normally equipped with the gecko tensile strength.
I have a feeling these are highly modified micro-robots.
They're not the ones you can buy at Target.
No. Because it doesn't only take six Target micro-robots to pull a car.
Because otherwise I have AAA and I'm going to get rid of it and just carry those robots around if the car ever breaks down.
Yeah, right. You drive off the side of the road, you just plant them on the street, and they go, it takes a long time. Like, the video that you were actually watching was sped up by multiple times. So there you go. But still, cool stuff. Robots do the darndest
things. They do. And when they're so small, they're so cute, you have no idea they're about to kill you and the rest of the human race.
Are we really that frightened of being killed by robots?
Yes.
Informal poll. Are we frightened about robots killing us?
Yes.
Okay, Anthony is. Greg
you
is
are.
Not.
I hear chat room. Yes.
I don't know if I actually am, so I'll side with no. So I think we're 50-50.
Just be prepared, and then you can be pleasantly surprised if they don't.
When I'm alive.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All righty. I'll go with that. That is it for today's show. Tomorrow's guest will be Nate Olivares-Giles from The Wall Street Journal. It'll be good to have Nate on. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be a part of the show by emailing us at tnt@twit.tv. You can also leave us a short voicemail at 260-TNT-SHOW, but don't worry, nobody ever does that. You can also hit us up on Twitter. We are at Tech News Today TV.
You can subscribe to our show, and people do. And if you haven't, you should. You can subscribe at twit.tv/TNT. And our Facebook page has moved.
Did it get more complicated or less complicated?
Less complicated.
Nice.
It's at facebook.com/technewstoday. Don't go anywhere else. I mean, you know, if you've liked our old page, like this one, facebook.com/technewstoday. Go there, like the page. And huge thanks to TNT fan Michelle Longpre-Boisvert from Longueuil, Quebec, and I apologize because I probably mispronounced your name, and you have been so kind to take care of facebook.com/technewstoday, and I appreciate it. Thank you for managing the community Facebook page, and thank you for handing it over. And you can always find me on Twitter. I am at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director, Anthony Nielsen, and all the folks who help us produce this show every single day, and thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye, everyone.
There's pie.
I wish that was a real pie.